First of all, thank you so much for coming back. Like, you know, it was,
that didn't scare people away.
I was, I very much enjoyed giving the shiur. I know that many of you, I don't know if I actually said where we're going to start from, but all we did last week was just give just an introduction to Jewish history. Why is Jewish history any different than regular history? So this week we're going to start right into where we're planning on starting, and that is the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. I guess I wanted to start here because it's post-biblical. You know, this is where the Tanakh is ending. Actually, there's like a little bit of an overlap. We have a few of the Nevi'im, the Treyasar, are finishing up now, but this is a lot of transitions are happening here. I guess you can start with the next one. Okay, so here we are. We're starting with that the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, according to outside sources, which seem to be pretty reliable. So the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 586 BCE. 586 BCE. That's before the Common Era, and pretty much most of the Bnei Yisrael, they were taken out of Eretz Yisrael. There was not that much left into Eretz Yisrael, and just even before that, really, it was the exile really took steps and stages. So really 150 years before that, the ten tribes were exiled. They were exiled by the Syrians. The Assyrians came. They exiled by a king by the name of Shalmaneser, and he exiled them, and that was it. So really the northern half of Eretz Yisrael was exiled by the Assyrians about 150 years before the actual Korban. And then what happened is 11 years, there was a series of kings, and Babel was getting stronger, and about 11 years before the actual destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, Nebuchadnezzar came and he exiled the king, King Yechonia, and the Tanakh brings down the Charash and the Maskir. Now, Charash and Maskir means the deaf and the lame people. So what does it mean? The Gemara tells us it means that this was the Sanhedrin. These were the cream of the crop. This was the best of the Jews. These are the Talmidei Chacham, and this was the Sanhedrin. We know in this group came Daniel, who wrote his Sefer in Babel as well. And King Yechonia was thrown into jail under Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king at the time. And they took in, these were the cream of the crop of the Jews, but they weren't taken in as slaves yet. You know, Nebuchadnezzar then for 11 years set up a puppet state. And this was a state that, you know, Israel, Yehuda, known at the time, was still going on. It was really subservient to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was calling shots. He actually called the king. And to show that he's so in charge, he actually changed the name of the king. The king had a name, and he changed his name to Tzidkiyahu. We know him as Tzidkiyahu, but his name was something else, just to show, listen, I'm in charge, you're really working for me. And that happened 11 years before, which was a tremendous, tremendous bracha for the Bnei Yisrael, because the few thousands of Jews that came to Babel, they made the infrastructure of a Jewish community. You can imagine, the Nevi'im were there, or the Sanhedrin. So they went ahead and they made yeshivos, and they made, you know, shuls, I guess we're going to start in this period. We'll talk about that soon. But they mikvos, whatever was needed for a Jewish community. 11 years later, when the destruction came, the Jews that came at that point were coming as slaves, as prisoners of war, and they were met by Babel. And they were met in Babel by an established Jewish community. A very high level, a very firm, a very the infrastructure was there. It was it was the best that one could hope for. Not only was it the best, it was also Babel, they spoke Aramaic. So Aramaic was actually like a sister language to Hebrew, so they were familiar with the culture was somewhat familiar, the language was familiar, and there were familiar faces. There were people there, all the Rashi yeshivas were there waiting for them with open arms. So that happened 11 years before, in the year 597. It's about that time that the yeshiva in Syria opened up. That's the yeshiva in Syria, and that probably was the the yeshiva in Syria continued without break. In other words, it was the yeshiva up until the year 1001. I think Rav Haigon was around when that yeshiva was there. So the yeshiva pretty much was about 1500 years old, yeshiva, just to continue. So the old joke is could you imagine what the deficit must have been? 1500 year. Just I think Oxford is the oldest institution of higher learning today, right? And when was Oxford opened? What, in the 1500s, I believe? I think in the 1500s, maybe early 1600s. So that's like 400 years is today's oldest institution is 400 years old. This was an institution running nonstop for about 1500 years.
What brought it to demise?
I don't remember the demise is really the breakup of the breakdown of the Jewish community in Babel at the time, and it broke down because of it started with a few different machlokesim, like it always does. Ooh, that's getting way ahead of our time. By the way, I was told if I'm not talking loud enough, just to signal, like you know, I'll raise it up a bit. So 11 years later, the Jews were exiled. 90% of the Jews went to Babel, about 10% went to Egypt. What then happened is that Nebuchadnezzar, for his own purposes, it was for his, he wanted to keep the community there going. And for Nebuchadnezzar, it would have been benefit. It was a tremendous benefit to keep people there, to keep Jews there. First of all, there were a lot of materials, resources that you can only get in Israel. One of the things in particular that they got from there was like the tchelis, the dyes. That was a very big supplier of world in terms of dyes, purple dyes and blue dyes. You know, kings would wear certain colors, and that was gotten from the chalazim. It was a very, very big industry in Israel. That, among other industries. And so what he did is he appointed another governor after he, you know, exiled most of the Jews. And the governor we all know was Gedalia ben Achikam. And we all know how that ended. This was he was a governor, and then there were some people there that were jealous of Gedalia. They felt that Gedalia was not from the royal line of David HaMelech. And there was this person, Yishmael ben Nesina, was from the line of David HaMelech. He felt he deserved to be the governor. And he had the backing of the king of Moab. And the king of Ammon or Moab, I think it was Ammon, he went ahead and he encouraged Yishmael to go ahead and assassinate Gedaliah, and he'd have the backing of the king of Moab, and he would be the next king. He would be the next governor. He would take over. And Gedali was actually warned of this. He knew about this, and he refused. This is a tragedy of it. He knew that it was coming, and he wouldn't believe the Lashon Hara. And as a matter of fact, he invited all of his Yishmael and his men in, and it was a very tragic. And on Rosh Hashanah, he was actually killed. And today we have a fast day. That's the fast day of Tom Gedalia, and that's the fast day of this is what happened. When that happened, so then Yirmiyahu was actually in that community, and Yirmiyahu said to the people, stay still, stay put, don't go anywhere, don't worry about it, just, you know, but everybody was afraid there of Nebuchadnezzar, that Nebuchadnezzar would come back, and Nebuchadnezzar would, in fact, punish them, and they all decided to go, and most of that community went to the community in Egypt. And Yirmiyahu writes to them that he writes that if you go there, it's going to be bad, because eventually you're going to be Babel is going to go ahead and attack Egypt, but they didn't listen to Yirmiyahu. They thought that Yirmiyahu was really working for himself. His student Baruch ben Neriah had not yet had prophecy, and they thought that Yirmiyahu was just sticking around. So till Baruch, you know, he wants everybody to stick around because his student Baruch didn't get Nevuah yet, and therefore they thought that he just wants them to stay till Baruch gets Nevuah, but it really wasn't in their best interest, which that wasn't the case, and it was tragic because had that community been able to stay, you never know what could have happened. It may not have had to have taken 7 years to build everything back up. Maybe the base of Mikdash could have happened a lot easier and a lot quicker. But once that community disbanded, there was actually nobody or nothing, for practical purposes, there in the land. In terms of Jews, we're all the other non-Jews. I think we're up to the So now let's talk about what happened. Now let's talk about the line, the Persian Persian lines. So Babel is the leader, and is the Nebuchadnezzar, and he has a son Evel Merodi, who has a son Belshazzar, and the son Belshazzar, in fact, was Evel Merodi even already was easier on the Jews a little bit. He actually allowed, when Nebuchadnezzar died, he took Yechenia, who was in jail, still in jail at the time, took him out and treated him nicely. But Belshazzar, there's a famous, very famous incident that happened with him. We have a very famous saying as well that comes from it. Belshazzar was making before all this happened, Yirmiyahu made a prediction. He made a nevuah. The nevuah was that 70 years, and 70 years is Bnei Yisrael is going to go back to Eretz Yisrael. The Golus is for 70 years. So Belshazzar made a calculation. His calculation came, he thought the 70 years started from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And he was wrong. It wasn't that time. But according to his calculations, the 70 years came, and the Jews were not back in Israel, and he made a party. And as a result, what did he do at that party? He took out a lot of the kalim from the Beis HaMikdash, and he had a big party. And in the middle of his party, there was it's recorded in Daniel, a hand came down, the form of a hand, and wrote words on the wall, right? We have the saying, like the writing on the wall. It really comes from here. And the words, the writing on the wall said, Mena mena takelu farsin, which basically said that what you've done is wrong, and you're going to be killed. So Belshazzar, nobody knew how to read it. I guess it says it was so very interesting. Even the Jews did not know how to read it. The question is, why couldn't they? So Belshazzar was a mess. He didn't know what these words meant. And his mother, who was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, said, wait a minute, what are you so concerned about? You have Daniel, right? Daniel was an advisor for Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel's around, he'll help you. And sure enough, they called him Daniel. Now, the reason why even the Jews couldn't read it is because the letters that came down were written like the letters of Ksav Ashuris, which is the writing that we have in the Sefer Torah. What seemed happened is that the writing, the letters sort of changed from Ksav Ashuris to a certain script letter, a certain line letter. And if you go today to all the archaeology places, you'll see of that time, if you see at the beginning of the second base of Mikdash, you'll see line letters, or first base, and you'll see line letters, not the box letters. The letters that were written were box letters, and we're going to see if probably next week or the week after that, in fact, Ezra, when he reestablishes the with the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, he's going to bring back the new lettering. He's going to bring back the lettering that we have today in the Sefer Torah, so it comes back to that lettering. So Belshazzar sees it. Daniel tells him it's bad news, and Belshazzar panics, and he says to everybody, and again, we may be familiar with this story as well, Belshazzar, he says, don't allow anybody, nobody can come in or out of the palace. According to, there are many versions of the Midrash and how this happened, but one of the versions is don't let anybody in the palace, even if he says he's Belshazzar. So even if he says it's me. And in the middle of the night, he had to go to the bathroom, and the guards that were there weren't there, so he went to the bathroom, and he came back, and he said, let me in. He says, who are you? He says, I'm Belshazzar, and they killed him. What was happening at that time is there was a battle that either happened that day or shortly before. The Persians were at war with the Babylonians, and the Babylonians beat them in the battle. But when this happened, when Belshazzar was killed, so again, different variations of the story, but one of the stories is that they took Belshazzar's head and they brought it out to the army, the Persian and the army, the Madai, Parasu Madai, they had an alliance together. They brought it out to the army and they showed him Belshazzar's head, and they just came in, that's it. It was like, I guess when the king is dead, there was a panic, people left, and they just walked in and took over the palace. So who took over the palace? So it was an alliance, and what they did is the alliance between the Persians and the Medians were, is that whoever, one would have the king and the other would have like the governors. So Daryavish, who was the first ruler, he was the older of the two, between him and Koresh, and he was the one that he took the kingdom, he took the kingship. So he was the king. And then Paras at that point had the governors. And he was king for a year. And then when he died, his son-in-law, which was Koresh, I think it was his son-in-law, I take that back, I'm not sure. But the king of the Koresh became the next king after Daryavish. And from then, the kingdom switched to Persia. And from then, it was the Persian kings. And I guess with a lot of Madai, they had a lot of the governors. So Koresh becomes king. Daryavish was king for a short time. Koresh became the king afterwards. And now, knowing again with a lot of the background and knowing the Jewish people and everything that was going on, Daryavish gives advice to Koresh, and he says to Koresh, you know, when you're a king or whatever, be nice to the Jews. And Koresh is, and he gives permission for many Jews to go back to build the base of Mikdash, go back to Eretz Yisrael and build the base of Mikdash, and quite a number of Jews go. Not a lot, but quite a number of them, led by a person by the name of Zerubbabel, which we'll talk about a little later, and we'll see what happens there in a second. Before I get back to Eretz Yisrael, let's just finish the line here. Koresh gives permission to the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Shortly afterwards, as you can see, the Kusim, we'll talk about soon as well. These were the people that were there. They slandered to Koresh, and they said, the Jews, you think they're building a base in Megdash? They're really building a fortress. They want to rebel. Koresh stops the construction. Just by the way, just you should know that the Chazal tell us when Koresh, what Nebuchadnezzar, what he did is he had, when he gathered, he pretty much had the entire world. What he did is with a lot of his treasures, he buried treasures in different areas. And what happened is Koresh, when he went ahead and he allowed the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael, so one of the treasures of Nebuchadnezzar he was able to find. What Nebuchadnezzar did is he took a boat, a lead boat, a heavy boat, and he made a hole in it and he sunk it into the ground. And what happened is that Koresh was redoing the Tigris River, he was making canals, and a certain area dried up of the river, and that's where the treasure was. So he ended up with a lot of the treasures. He became very rich, which Ahasuerus inherited, and that's going to cause him a problem as well. Koresh stops the construction. Sometime afterwards, Achashverosh becomes king. We are all familiar with Achashverosh. This is the sources that are in the Torah. This is the way the Torah brings the sources. Dayavish, Koresh, Achashverosh. We all know in the story of Achashverosh is the story of Purim. I know we have to go through that. Achashverosh marries Esther, and they have a son. And that son is Dayavish. Now, Dayavish could either be known as Dayavish. In Nehemiah, he's referred to as Atarzerxes, however you say it, Atarzerxes, and he allows the Jews to build the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, Dayavish was Jewish. He happened to have been Esther's son. Okay, and a different Dayavish. It is a Dayavish that was before Koresh. Dayavish, Koresh, Kusim. Dayavish, Koresh, Achashverosh, Dayavish. That's the way we have it in Chazal. That's the way Chazal has it. And he, when Dayavish came the second time around, that's when Ezra came with. He left with 40,000 Jews, and that was the real beginning. And Ezra's going to come to Eretz Yisrael, and he's going to be there with the Jews that were there earlier with Zerubbabel, and later after Ezra, and Nehemiah is going to come. But before we get to there, there is just one thing I wanted to show you, is that in Chazal, we have four Persian rulers. But if you hit the next slide, if you notice, we happen to know of 11, at least 11 Persian rulers that ruled during that time, from outside sources. So a lot of them have the same names. And the question is who is really our Achashverosh? There are at least three Achashverishes. There are at least three Atarzerxeses, at least three Dayavises. Cyrus is there's one. There's some say Cambyses is also known as Koresh. See, Koresh and Dayavish became names like president, Kaiser. It was a paro. It was a name of a king. So, you know, Caesar. So, you know, Koresh could have been known as, you know, everybody could have been called the name Koresh. So, really, one of the things we don't know which of who we are talking about. Are we talking about Xerxes II? He became king, and that's Achashverosh, or is it Xerxes III? And that's a question that they try to find. So, you know, you try to find, like it says in the Megillus Esther, that Achashverosh went on wars and he was successful. So there were about all three of them went on wars and they were successful. Some of them were not successful later. We'll get to the years. So that's a bigger problem than knowing who the
peace states. Are these according to
secular sources?
To Chazal or
This is something I pulled out of a secular source. It goes earlier and later, but I figured I'd start with, say, they have it, Cyrus of Persia sacks Babylon and frees the Jews. Just goes down. I just took the entire timeline until Alexander the Great conquers Persia. But these noticing here, even bring down, there's Atarzerxes, is three of them. Xerxes is at least, here it says two. Dayavish, there are two or three of them. So we just have a hard time trying to figure out, you know, where we come in and they come in.
Do we know?
What was that? Oh, okay. I'm sorry?
Do we know from Jewish sources how long Esther's son might have reigned?
I don't think we do know, but when I learned before I started looking now, when I learned Nehemiah and it said Artaxerxes, so it said Artaxerxes, that's how it's written in Daniel, knowing that Dayavish was the king, I thought Dayavish became king when he was very young. Achashverosh was only king for 14 years. He married Esther in his, seventh year? In the seventh year he married Esther. That means it could have been that Dayavish was, 7 years old when he became king. So he probably had a regent by the name of Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes. That's the way I understood it. And that may be some of what's going on here as well. Some may have been regents, maybe there was a prime minister and a king, so they could have overlapped. But this is what they have and what we have. Okay, the next slide. Okay, just I think I just mentioned some of these are some of the mysteries of the time, and they're very very they are issues, and they're dealt with, you know, from our side and from the historical perspective. But just going for the first one is what happened to the 10 tribes, and you know, Chazal tell us some Chazal says that they're not coming back. That's it, they're gone. Others say no, they're beyond the river Sambatyon, and they're coming back by Mashiach. We'll see them again. But the question that we have, and the Navi tells us places where they went, right? We do know the cities or the areas where they went, to see the people that are there now. Are those the people of the 10 tribes or not? Well, we don't know. I mean, that's still up for grabs. You could try to say, well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But the biggest problem is the biggest question that they have is, if you had a people that were just regular people and they were sent to different places, so that's one thing. But here you had the 10 tribes were a highly cultured people with a very, very strong identity. They were, even with all their Avodah Zarahs, they all knew the Torah, they all followed the Torah. They had a history among themselves, and it just seems very, very strange, very hard to understand how such a people would just disappear like that. Like, how does that happen? Like, you know, you would expect that people that go from one place to the other, they bring with them things. So there's records. There's something. It's like you know, somebody turned the light out. That's it. There's no record. We know the places where they were sent. And, you know, we know there's just no record. You would have expected, like what happened with Yehuda, when they came to Babel, the community continued. They took what they had with them, and they brought with them to Babel. So that's one of the just strangest, really big questions, what happened. We also have, I guess, a tradition is that of the 10 tribes, they really weren't 10 tribes. They were less. Throughout the years, many times they were in a state of war between one and two, but many of the Jews did come back to Yehuda. And even though maybe many of the people were exiled, but there were people that came down into Yehuda, they escaped to Yehuda. So I guess we have a tradition that from all of us here today, we're all from the 10 tribes. We're called Jews. The word Jews comes from Judah, and that was the Malchus Yehuda. That's where that was the country that went to Babel, and this is where we're all called Judah from Yehuda. But that's because that's the main Shevet. But from all the other Shvatim, Shimon was always in Yehuda. You had Levi that was here too, Binyamin that was with us as well, and from other Shvatim also. We have a tradition that we have from all the Shvatim, but the bulk is from Yehuda. The second one, and this is probably the hardest question to answer, and that is we happen to be missing 166 years in Chazal. Now, again, from the outside sources, they say that the first Beis Hamikdash was destroyed in 586 before the Common Era. We know that the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed in 70 of the Common Era. Right? 70 of the Common Era. So if you add up, now we also have a tradition. We know Chazal tell us that the second Beis Hamikdash was, second Beis Hamikdash was 420 years. So if you have 420 years and we know that the exile was only 70 years, right? Only 70 years. The 70 years, I guess, ended up was from the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, right? Belshazzar made when Nebuchadnezzar first became king. Achashverosh's cheshbon was the 11 years, was the 11 years before when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the kingdom and made it his puppet kingdom. But the third one was finally when Daryavish finally said, hey, you can go back. And that was 70 years. In our tradition, it was 70 years from the first Korban. But if you do the dates don't match up. The outside sources say that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed 586 of the before the Common Era. Now, if you want to just say that that's not true, okay, you know, maybe the outside sources have it wrong, and then you know we just move everything down a bit. But that's a real big issue. It was Reb Schwab, Reb Shimon Schwab, Zatzal came out with a pamphlet about this. He deals with the question, and at first, when he first came out saying that Chazal took 166 years and hid it. That's it. They made believe it didn't exist. So in fact, the Gullus was not 70 years. The Gullus was 236 years, and everything happened from the second Beis HaMikdash 166 years later. He retracted that. Right? He came out with a second. He came out with a second retraction. I saw the first one. I started reading it. I didn't get through the first Reb Schwab. The second one I didn't see, but they say that he retracted it. And that's a serious. There are people that try to answer it. Like I said, they say the kings are doubling one up on another. I guess around they talk about that. And the third question is, like I mentioned before, is which Persian emperor Chazal is talking about? Again, I mentioned there's about 11. During the time of these four, the outside sources have about 11. Okay, so that's now we're ready to come into, that was all, now we're coming into Eretz Yisrael. Any questions on what we, up until now? Okay, so that was Babel, which turned into Persia. Persia is now the big guy on the block. They are the big empire. Again, their Persian Empire stretched the entire civilized world, and that's why it was so. That's why the story of so big is that they did have the ability to destroy all the Jews in the story of Purim with Haman and Esther. And okay, so now what happens is Daryavish gives permission for the Jews to go back. I'm sorry, let's go back. This is earlier. Koresh, this is the first time around, Koresh goes ahead and gives permission for the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Zerubbabel, which I mentioned before, was from the line of the house of David. So he had royal blood in him. He was a government in exile or a government in practice, and had the Persians given the Jews the right to start their own country, Zerubbabel would have been the king, and the line of David would have continued. We're going to see that in the entire second Beis HaMikdash, the leaders of the Jewish people are not going to be from the house of David, from the place David, but they're going a good portion of the time, they're going to be from Kohanim, they're going to be from Hashmonaim. But this was the. So he comes in, and he came in with a few thousand people. Now, he came in, he had a few issues he had to deal with. And I guess if you want to, just as a side, you take a look at patterns. And just when you see the issues that Zerubbabel had to deal with, just think about the issues that we today in Eretz Israel have to deal with ourselves. And I always say, as much as things change, you know, as much as things stay the same. I mean, it's just the same, a lot of the same patterns that Zerubbabel and the Jews at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash had to deal with. We're going to deal with it. We're going to deal with ourselves as well. All right. Zerubbabel comes back with a few thousand people, and he comes back, and there's a great excitement. And they come back, and they find that there are a few. The country is inhabited by many other nations, the areas that have nations, but not Jews. They really aren't Jews, and they come back. Now, the first is they're greeted by the Shomronim. Who are the Shomronim? The Shomronim are also known as the Kusim. What's with the Kusim? Where do they come from? Well, Now we got to go back to the 10 tribes. So how did the Kusim get their names, and who are they? When Shalmaneser, when Shalmaneser exiled the 10 tribes, so he put another people in their place. You see, the Assyrian foreign policy, okay, was as follows. They would go ahead, they'd conquer a country, and they would not, and they'd conquer a second country. And basically, they would not leave the people in the country that they conquered living in that land. Why? Because people who lived in a certain land, they develop a certain attachment to the land, a certain, maybe you want, we would call it today, some a certain amount of nationalism, and they're more likely to go ahead and rebel against the invading country. So the Assyrians did not want to have to deal with any of this. So they would come into a country, they'd conquer the country, and what they do is they pick up all the inhabitants and they'd move them to another country. And they take the inhabitants of another country and they'd move them to this country. And that was basically their foreign policy. That's what they did. And that's what it says, is that the Assyrians came and they will mavalvil the entire world. In what way did that affect us? They mixed up the entire world. How does that affect us? It affects us like this. We have there's a law in the Torah. We're not allowed to marry anybody from Moab or Ammon, ever. Right? These were two nations that when we came out of Egypt, they should have come with bread and water. You know, we had a nice long relationship back there. Their Alta Zaidi and our Alta Zaidi saved their Alta Zaidi in the war, and we were so nice to him. And what do? When we come back, they don't greet us with bread and water, and they brought Bilam to try to curse us. And Hashem said, that's no gratitude. You're showing a lack of a karas hatov. Forget it. They're out. We don't want to have anything to do with such a people. And it writes in the Torah that Ammon and Moab can never marry into Klal Yisrael. Comes along Shalmaneser, and he conquers the world. What does he do? He takes the people from Ammon, and he picks them up, and he moves them to another country. He takes people from another country and moves them into the area of Ammon. Now, if I were to ask you, if somebody came from the country of Ammon or Moab, would they be allowed to marry into Klal Yisrael? And the answer is, the question came up in the Gemara in Brachos, I think it was, right? It came up that somebody, he was known as Ammoni, and he got up and he said, can I marry into Klal Yisrael? It happened to have been on a very famous day that the question came up. They had deposed the Rosh Hashiva, and they made a new Rosh Hashiva, and this is when they sided with the new Rosh Hashiva, and then the old Rosh Hashiva realized, he said, uh-oh, I did some soul searching, but that's not for now. We'll get to what that was. But next, Mark came out and said, no, since Shalmaneser, since the Assyrians mixed up the entire world, there's a concept called the Parish Merubaka Parish. If you're separated from wherever you are, we assume you're from the most of the amount and not from the minimum of the amount. And therefore we say everybody is, unless somehow we would know for sure you are a real Ammon or Moab, but just because you came from that country, it doesn't mean you're from Ammon or Moab. What Shalmaneser did is when he came to Israel and he exiled the 10 tribes, or the northern half of the country of Israel, he brought these people in from other places. And one of the places they brought the people in was from Kuta. I think some people say that today would be Crete. An island near Israel, so he picked up the people and he moved them into Kut. He moved them into the northern half of Israel. And they were living there, and then they had a big problem. You know, some people have rat problems, right? You know, some people have, you know, cockroach problems. They had a problem with lions. Just open the door, lion right there. They had lions, and they were being attacked by a lion. And they didn't know what to do. So they go to Shalmaneser, they go to the king, and they said, listen, we can't stay here because the god of this land doesn't, you know, we don't know his rules, we don't know the laws, and therefore we don't know what to do, and we don't, you know, we can't stay here, it's dangerous, he doesn't want us here. So he got, the king, the Assyrians got a Kohen, this is what it brings down in Malachim, they got a Kohen to go ahead and teach all of these people about Torah. Now, I don't know, I guess, I'm not sure why he didn't, he did a pretty good job, but I don't know why he just didn't teach him everything. But basically he taught him Torah Shebiksav. He taught him what's written, the written Torah, not the oral law, just the written. And they picked up, so it says that the Kusim, they pick up, they took on them some of the laws, but not every, all the laws. But it says about a Kusi that the laws that they took, they were stark. They were strong in those. They did it better than the Jews. They did it better, in the, better than the Jews. So the Jews come back. The Jews come back from Babel, and who's there? The Kusim. And they say, oh, you're building a base of Mikdash. Great, we're joining you. And they said, no such thing. We don't want you. They are not real Jews. You're only Kusim. And that was it. So what do they do in the time-honored Middle East culture? So they started a two-pronged war. The first war was the publicist war. This was the political campaign. They got on all the newspapers. They got on all the wires. And they started spreading lies about the Jews, and it got back all the way to, they sent people back to Persia. This is, again, this is the first time around by Koresh, and Koresh heard what's going on, and Koresh said, that's it, stop the building. So the building was stopped because of the Kusim. What happened is, in addition, is they also started a terror campaign. They would do things to cause the Jews to feel very, very insecure, hoping that the Jews would leave. So this like sounds familiar, you know. It's different players, but the same playbook. You know, that's basically what it was. Yes.
So when they were refused participation to rebuild the base of Mikdash, was that part of the 14 years that you had shown on the other side? Or was that an addition?
That's, I don't know. Because it could, right. It could be because they first started.
That explains part of the 166 years.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be that long between.
No, but I mean, if you're eating into that time.
Right.
Do we know when the second base at Mikdash was actually dedicated?
The second base, yeah, we do know. Well, again, you'd ask us, or you'd ask them. They have it much earlier. And we have the second base of Mikdash 420. So they may have our second base of Mikdash earlier.
Because the difference between the dedication date and when they started the construction.
Right. You could also gain a few years there. That's correct. Yes. You're not going to gain that much.
But you can make a presumption
right,
that there were delays.
14, 20 years. Right. It's not going to be that much. I think. Again, between Koresh. So Koresh, you had a few years there. You had 14 years of Achashverosh. It's about 20. I'm guessing about 20, 25 years. The difference between the two. They're all going to still be alive when the second wave comes in, when Ezra comes in. Now, just also as I just these Kusim, they became Jews because of lions. So the Gemara always brings down: are they Geirei Emes? Were they true converts? Or they Geri Arayo, so they converts because of lions. And it was a very, very big debate. And these Kusim are going to cause problems for the Jews for about 600 years. So this was a 600-year problem. You know, and it was a big issue. At some point, what happened is their base was in Shechem, on Har Gerizim and Har Evo. And about 600 years later, when they went, they saw a dumus. This is already in the times of the Tanayim, in the times of the Gemara. They saw like a form of a bird. And they realized that they were doing idol worship. And that's it. They said, that's it. They're totally out. Nothing to do with the Kusim. The debate, are they partially Jews or not? Could you eat the Mishnah says you could eat their matzahs. You know, they make matzahs. Shmura matzahs were just as good as Ashmura matzahs. And you could use their matzahs to be yotzei the mitzvah. That was something that they took on themselves. They also, we'll see later when we get to the calendar, they learned the pasuk that Pesach, that the Omer on Pesach always had to be brought on a Sunday, because the Pasuk uses the term in Mimachras HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos. So we learn it. The Shabbos means Yontif, means the first day of Yontif. Is Shabbos is that day of rest. But they said, no, Shabbos is Shabbos. So when we would make the count, we had a great system. In terms of, I think it was about 10 mountains, they were able to do these, they put on 10 mountains these blue fires. We'll get to it more. And the blue fires went from Babel, went from Yerushalayim to Babel. And within one night, Babel knew when the Rosh Chodesh was, right? Tonight's Rosh Chodesh, tomorrow's Rosh Chodesh. Is Rosh Chodesh one day? Is it 2 days? Right? Is it, because the Hebrew month is 29 and a half days. So some days it's going to be a 2 day Rosh Chodesh or a 1 day Rosh Chodesh. So you get the fires, you get the lights up there, you know today's Rosh Chodesh. And it was very important then to know Rosh Chodesh. It didn't go by a calendar. It had to go by when Beis Din said it was Rosh Chodesh, that was Rosh Chodesh. And the Kusim used to play around with the lights. They would go up on a mountain because they wanted Pesach to come out on a Sunday. So on the wrong night, they would go up and they'd start the lights and people would pick it up and they would think that Rosh Chodesh was the wrong way. As a matter of fact, because of that, they had to stop the entire system and they had to come up with another system which we'll talk about then. So they were so that's the first thing that Zerubbabel came. That was his first problem. And the next problem that he had was the Ruchnius problem. Okay, so the Jews came, they were all excited, they were ready to build the base of Mikdash, and they start going, and then all of a sudden they get word from Persia, from the center, that's it, nope, you gotta stop. So they were depressed. As a matter of fact, they also started to intermarry. Now, it seems strange, but the intermarriage, the Isser of intermarrying is not, there was always an Indian of Kanaya Pogumbo, but the Isser of intermarrying was not like a real Isser up until later. But in fact, they did have for themselves foreign wives. They may have had Jewish wives as well, but many of them had foreign wives. And the last thing is that the markets were open on Shabbos as well. And that was the market day in Yerushalayim. So either some actually went and opened their store, and some had partners with Goyim, and some they only did everything with a Shinoi. And there was certain. We're going to see how Ezra's going to deal with this later as well. But Ezra's going to deal with the intermarriage issue and the markets open on Shabbos issue. Now, the physical state of the Jews was, you know, it's few in number. They came with a few thousand, not that many. So you don't have a very strong army, a strong amount of people. There was no army. They didn't have an army. I don't know if they were even allowed to have an army. And it was a poor country. It wasn't that, you know, it was... there was a lot of rich people, a lot of resources. And where was the land? Now, the land, besides, again, the land itself, it was a small amount of land, no organized army, but the border basically was the Yishuv at that point was around Yerushalayim. I guess about 20, 25 miles north and all around Yerushalayim. Hebron, in that time, I believe, was not part. They didn't even make it to Hebron. Hebron was not part of the original Yishuv. In terms of natural resources, what do you have? It's hilly. You could plant things, but it's not like you had major industry. Yerushalayim, if I'm not mistaken, is the only ancient city, major ancient city, that's not built next to water, next to a river, an ocean, or any accessible to water. Because in the old days, in the ancient days, that was the way that they made. That's the way that you traveled. That's how you exported. That's how you moved things around. You know, in large things, you're able to easier to move things in boats and move it with water than not. So I think it was the only country that really was a major city that was not built around a water source. So if you know when you start to be, you see the beginning of what's going on here in Eretz Yisrael, and you begin to realize what they did accomplish was really amazing. You know, they have two hands tied behind their back, and they're gonna pull it off, and they're gonna pull it off at some point in the few years after the second, within 100 years, they're gonna be a very, very powerful nation. It's going to be the strongest nation in the area. It's going to be the strongest country in the area. So now we get to the people that... Now comes in Ezra and Nehemiah. And what happened is now comes after the story of Achashverosh. We mentioned Dayavish. Dayavish says Jews can go back. Okay, so now enter two people. Now, I guess Jewish history really is filled with people, great people. Great people at great times. They're going to come in. They fill the breach. We could, you know, in every generation, you could turn and you could say, yeah, that was the person. He was the person that did it then. So you have two people that are going to turn everything around in a very, very short time, and those are Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra was the Talmud of Baruch ben Neriah, who was the Talmud of Yirmiyahu Hanavi. So the Mesorah from Moshe Rabbeinu. And if you want to read the Hakdama, the Rambam in his Hakdama to Mishnayis goes through the Mesorah. We know the Rebbe, the Talmud, and it all goes to Yirmiyahu, it goes to Baruch ben Neriah, and it goes to Ezra. Now Ezra did not go back with Zerubbabel, because his Rebbe Baruch ben Neriah was still alive. While Baruch was alive, Ezra stayed in Babel. But at this point, now when the second Dayavish comes and gives the proclamation, everybody can go back. So now Ezra is ready to go back, and he brings with him 40,000 people. 40,000. Before he leaves Babel, he separates the yichus. Anybody with bad yichus, anybody, if there were any mamzerim, if there were any type of yichus issues at all, heritage issues, people that don't have good lineage. So they were separated out. He actually brought them with him. He tried to get these people to come with him so he could take care of them. But he had a problem getting two groups of people he couldn't get. He couldn't get, for the most part, he couldn't get the bulk of the Talmidei Chachamim, and he could not get Leviim. Now Leviim, they weren't coming with them. And as a matter of fact, because he couldn't get the Leviim, they lost something. They lost their rights to the Miser. Now, Miser, a tithe, the tithes. The Torah tells us that the way you're supposed to give it, the person gets a bushel. He gets a pile, let's say, of 100 apples. So he's supposed to give the first thing he gives to the Truma. And we say it's about 2%. You get two apples to the Kayin. That's Truma. Then he's supposed to give a tenth. So of the 98 apples left, he gives 9.8 apples to the Levi. And that's these 9.8 goes to Levi, and that's called Miser Rishon, the first tithe. And there's a second tithe. And that really depends on the year. But on the year 1, 2, 4, and 5, those four, it's called Miser Sheni, which is the second tithe. And you're supposed to take that tithe on 8.8. Takes about another eight apples. He's supposed to take them to Yerushalayim. He's supposed to eat them in Yerushalayim. And on year 3 and 6, this is a 7-year cycle, on year 3 and 6, you give it to the poor people. And what am I left with? And then you have a year of Shemitah. You don't pay, there's no tithes, no truma. You let the year go, you let the land go fallow, and then it starts over again. So what Ezra said is to the Leviim, and you're not coming to Eretz Yisrael, you're not getting your tithe. And for the time during the second base of Mikdash, the tithes, the Miser, was given to Kohanim as well. Because Kohanim are really Leviim. They're from the tribe of Levi, they're like super Leviim. He does something else, Ezra. And he has a gathering called the Bris Amana, where he gathered all of the people in Eretz Yisrael together, all the Jews together. And it was a bris of tshuva. It was a tshuva movement. And he got up there and he started speaking to them. And he individually brought people up, and he, those people that were intermarried, and he started talking to them, and he made sure that every person who had an intermarried wife got rid of them. If not, they were excommunicated. And there were some families that were excommunicated. But for the overall, most of them got rid of their wives. He dealt with the Shabbos issue in the Bris Amana, and he came up with a lot of takanas. You know, buying and selling on Shabbos. You know, on Shabbos you're not allowed to make a kinyan. What's a kinyan? A transaction. A change of ownership. Transaction of ownership. That you can't do on Shabbos. But that came because of Ezra. Min haTorah. For the Torah doesn't necessarily talk about that. But a lot, he instituted a lot of takanos, a lot of laws, decrees, so it should not look like, it should not, anything that would be like business. That he got rid of as well. So that was pretty much Ezra. Now, in order to enforce it all, he had somebody who came with him, and that was Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah was a... He came from a different part. He was very wealthy. He was the cup bearer to the king of Persia. And what that means is, I guess he was like his national security advisor, if you want to call it like that. Because when he handed the cup of wine to the king, what was he telling the king? It is safe. There's nothing wrong with this cup of wine. Right, and we know what the Sarah Mashkin in the story of Mitzrayim, right? The one whose Paro had two of his officers, the Sarah Mashkin, the one who was the wine bearer, the butler, and the baker, they were thrown in the jail, right? Because when there was a rock and when there was a fly in the cup. So why was he throwing it to you? It means that there's a fly in the cup. That's the problem. You know, you're working for. How could you do that? That is almost like a rebellion. You know, if you are supposed to make sure all my food is good. So that's the relationship he had with the king, and he was able to convince the king. And it's almost like probably miraculous, where he said to the king, "Do me a favor. Let me go with my people. Let me sort out everything in Israel. Let me get everything going, and then I'll come back." And the king agreed. Not only did the king agree, but he sent him with an army. He promoted him, he gave him the title of a governor, so he was like on the level of any governor that there was around, and he was given an army, and he went to Eretz Yisrael. And he says the first day he got there, he didn't announce, "Here I am, the new governor." So you read in Nehemiah, he comes in quickly during the day, unannounced. He goes at night, surveys the wall of Yerushalayim, sees where all the breaches are, and he does a lot. First of all, anything Ezra wanted, Nehemiah did for him. That was like, you know, he was like the strong guy. He was also very rich, and he brought a lot of money with him. He fixed up the walls of Yerushalayim. Before Nehemiah came, Ezra got the Beis HaMikdash going. He had a Beis HaMikdash, but basically there was no protection, and he built the wall. There's one more on Nehemiah, and Nehemiah, he secures the Yisha from attacking neighbors, and he becomes the enforcer for Ezra. Also, at some short time, he ends up after this, he is called back, and he in fact goes back to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, I just want to, I guess I could stop here. Just the accomplishments, I guess we'll talk about next time. So we'll pick it up next time. We're going to review what the accomplishments of Ezra and Nehemiah are, and we're going to go into the Beis HaMikdash, the differences between the two Beis HaMikdashes, and the beginning of the Greeks. We got a new country, we have a new battle. New battle coming up. Any questions or anything? All right. Thank you all for coming.